Hello and a very warm welcome to episode 13 of the Cardiff Podcast. My name is Alistair Love. This week's guest is Jeff Collins, who will be a familiar face to many of you after a long and distinguished career in news and sports broadcasting in Wales and beyond. Music also runs through his veins, and he's written books on Stuart Cable and the famous Rockfield Studios in Monmouth that hosted world-famous bands including Led Zeppelin and Motorhead's name but two. And Jeff has rubbed shoulders with many of these legendary musicians who used those studios. That wasn't enough. Jeff is a staple on the institution that is Soccer Saturday on Sky Sports as a roving reporter and can make Yeovil against, I know, Cosmoston Lakes sound thrilling, which is a great skill in itself. So we talked about the end of last season before considering Cardiff City's prospects this season, which is already underway, of course, and many, many other things. We cover an awful lot of ground in our hour together. But I'm not really doing Jeff justice, so really is best to crack on. We met up in the Black Lion in Llandaff over a pint, and it sounded very much like this. We do need to reflect on the end of the season, because it was so tumultuous. Obviously, for your sort of Sky Sports hat, I think we really do need to start with a reflection on the end of the season, particularly in the context of Cardiff City and Swansea City. And obviously, since the last time we spoke, Gareth Bale in the Champions
League
final.
I mean, yeah, the football season has been incredible. I mean, I remember reflecting, I was talking to someone about 2 or 3 years ago, probably longer actually, 4 or 5 years ago, and I was just saying, It was only about a decade ago where I was saying to people there were probably 4 things I didn't think I'd ever see in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And that was Wales winning another Grand Slam at rugby, and then of course 2005 and they won 3.
Yes.
Wales qualifying for a major football tournament, because it just seemed so unlikely
that
back then.
I never thought that would ever happen.
And, and it happened in 2016. Yeah. Cardiff getting promoted to the Premier League, because again, you know, when I came back from London, where I'd been working at ITN and Sky, and I came back here to present sport for BBC Wales, Cardiff were in Division 4.
Yeah.
Basement division, and they were yo-yo clubs. So as I got here, they got promoted under Frank Burrows to Division 3. Next season, relegated straight back down.
Yeah.
And they were just this perennial yo-yo club, and you never thought they'd get out. And I remember, you know, when we were getting a few seasons ago, and Dave Jones telling people, you know, when they were asking to replace him, to be careful what they wished for, because he was a good manager, I thought.
I
thought the attitude of some Cardiff fans was that they had a right, once they got to the Championship, they had a right to be fighting for playoffs and promotion every season. I used to keep saying to them, look, guys, you don't have the right. Look at other clubs, you know, and once you back down against, you know, like Coventry City, once you back down there, it's really hard. And I remember when I was here in 99, first season back, some of the Cardiff games at Nuneaton Park on a Tuesday night, you'd have 800 people there. And then you'd go on a Saturday, it'd be 1,100.
Yeah.
Now we're getting 20,000. Yeah. It's incredible. But after what we've seen, you know, I thought Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, when he took over from, you know, in the Premier League, I thought he must have learned from Sir Alex Ferguson. I was expecting, and bear in mind, you've taken a club that's never won a title in Norway, Molde in Norway, to take a club with no history of winning anything to the title, league title in your first season, you must have something.
Yeah.
So I had great expectations. But he was awful, and we lost every game 3-4, 5-0. And then the next few seasons were just dire. So I went into this season, even though we had Neil Warnock, not really expecting too much, hoping for the playoffs, maybe if we were lucky. And to see what they did, six games unbeaten at the start, flying high, second most of the season.
Yeah.
It was incredible the way he brought that team together, despite not spending much money.
Yeah.
And he got them playing, and he got them unbeatable. And
we were unpleasant to play against, and that's a very underrated virtue in a football team. No one would want to play Cardiff. That's what I'm taking into the new season. I'm hoping that we can bring that sort of level of organisation, but you know, sort of nastiness and difficulty to play against.
And I think people focus on that. I remember watching the victory over Leeds 3-1. I think we beat Villa 4-0. There were some games last season where we were playing beautiful football.
Yeah.
We were playing we can play amazing football on the day, but what we want to be difficult to beat, which you need, because how many teams, you know, you play, well, Arsenal are a perfect example. You play beautiful football 1 week, you get a tough game the next week, and you lose.
Yeah.
And you're right, I think the Premier League is quite weak at the moment. There are a number of teams with championship squads, like Huddersfield, like Newcastle, like Brighton, and teams like Watford and Bournemouth, who are not maybe as great as teams in the past were. So I think Cardiff, you know, can do good things. I think they can survive. But I must admit, again, I think it's funny, everyone's tipping us to be last.
Everyone thinks
Watford and Fulham play beautiful football, so they'll survive. But will they? Exactly what you were saying. Yes, Watford and Fulham, sorry, yes, Fulham and
Fulham
Wolves
in particular,
play lovely football.
Yeah, yeah.
But when they're up against the big teams, can they defend? Can they keep clean sheets? Now, as you say, Cardiff have that knack of keeping clean sheets.
Yeah.
You know, being a difficult team to beat, that might be better to have than what Wolves and Fulham have. So,
and actually, if you think back to the last time we were in the Premier League, sadly it was all too brief. We were difficult to beat, and under Malky Mackay, we were incredibly difficult to beat. And actually, I think we had a fighting chance of staying up if he'd continue. I mean, it's all water under the bridge. I know.
No, I think up until I remember going away to watch them against Fulham, where we won 2-1 away, and we were, I think we were seventh in the league, and it was incredible. And I think come Christmas time, we were 12th or 13th. I think we'd have survived. Yeah. Soon as Malky left, and as I say, it wasn't just narrow defeats. We were suddenly losing at home 3-0 to Crystal Palace, 3-0 to Hull.
Difference.
We were conceding so many goals that it just became. And then I think, you know, one of the key games, we had to beat Sunderland away. If we beat them away, we might have stayed up. And we lost 4-0. And you think, we were just losing so heavily, it was silly. Yeah. It was silly.
It was embarrassing, wasn't it?
So this time, I've got to say, I think Neil Warnock is a smart chap. He's never been given a really good shot in the Premier League. But the way he organises teams, the way he scouts players, I think people have underestimated us. You know.
And do you know another thing as well? He will love that we've been written off already.
Absolutely, yes.
All season he's saying, well, the playoffs would be an achievement, even when we were second and on a golden run.
Oh, absolutely.
He would play it down all the time. He's a canny guy. When we appointed him, I thought, he's got the know-how, but has he still got the appetite? My God, he's proved he did.
Well, 8 promotions, you know, a record for any manager. I mean, clearly the top managers are all in the top league and never get promotions because they're already there. But in that, amongst that level, to be alongside the likes of Graham Taylor and Dave Bassin and to suddenly, you know, 8 promotions, that's just staggering.
Stunning. It's a stunning achievement. And I actually think the one thing that does give me hope, I think what you've alluded to already, I reckon probably up to 8th, it's not no great shakes. Organised against that 8th downwards, you've got a chance.
I think Neil himself, he said the top 6, I think I'd put it down to 8, maybe even the top 10. But once you take the top 8 out of the equation, I just don't think the other teams, they're quite Premier League savvy, but I don't think they're unbeatable.
No.
If you look at Bournemouth and Watford, do you really quake in your shoes? Do you really say, oh, Cardiff City playing Bournemouth, we've got no chance? Really?
Yeah.
Of course, you know, when you talk about going away to Chelsea and Arsenal and Spurs, well, that. But again, the thing about the Premier League, you know, there's always upsets. You can't. We remember from the last time we were in the Premier League, beating Manchester City 3-2 when we were 3-1 up.
Yeah.
And I think when we drew at home with Man United and it was 2-2, we were far better than they were that day. They were lucky to get the 2-2 draw. So, you know, you can achieve the occasional upset.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a great season, you know.
And obviously Burnley are the kind of role model, aren't they? So
perfect
role
model.
That's what we need to be aspiring to.
Incredibly low wages. No real star players. I mean, there's no real member of that team you'd look at and say, wow, that's their talisman. And I don't mean this in an offensive way, but they are a bunch of journeyman players in a sense. And I don't mean that in that kind of, you know, they just fit in and do nothing. But I mean, he's just taken a load of very good footballers and melded them together and made them play as a team. Yeah. And they're greater than the sum of their parts. And what they've achieved, to come seventh and to qualify for Europe, is staggering. I think Sean Dyche said this week that actually he was quite flattered by getting all these comments, people saying he should have been the manager of the season. And, you know, clearly Pep getting 100 points. Pep getting 100 points. Winning the league by 21 points is something special. But
it is.
But what he's done is amazing. You know?
It's fair to say Pep had a few more bob to spend than Sean Dyche.
Yes.
I was chatting to Alan Curtis. I hope you may have heard it. Popped along to the FAW coaches conference.
I did,
was saying how difficult it is to stay in the Premier League. And for all our hopes, it is undeniably incredibly difficult. And actually, it was a great achievement for Swansea to sustain that over those 6 seasons, was it?
Yeah, seven seasons. I heard that podcast. I like Alan. As a kid, I grew up watching him. That was the Wales team when I was a teenager, watching Robbie James and Terry Earth and all those players, and Leighton James. James was probably the best player I've ever seen.
Oh, really?
Amazing player. I think he was so talented. Yeah. Brian Flynn, what a great player he was. And Alan, he's done a great job at Swansea. He's been there for so long in so many roles. And what Swansea did, and what you think their first 3-4 seasons, they were incredible. The football they played, and again to qualify for Europe, and to win the League Cup. And I think under Laudrup, they were playing such magnificent football. Sad that they lost their way after Laudrup. They suddenly decided to abandon their philosophy, the way they played, and just go kick and chase. And they've been lucky the last 2 or 3 seasons. Mm. Sad to see them go down. I'd rather have 2 Welsh teams. Can you imagine? You know, 2 Welsh teams out of 20. 2 teams out of 20 are Welsh in the Premier League. That's an incredible statistic. If it had happened, you know.
And you know, there's possibly Cardiff fans who wouldn't agree, but there's a lot who would have liked to have seen a derby, for example. I've always got too tense with the derbies, but you're right. In terms of, we'd be punching above our weight for South Wales have two Premier League clubs.
Because we do as well. You mentioned Gareth Bale earlier, and again, here's a star man in the Champions League final. And it's a Welshman. He comes on, scores that incredible goal, which, you know...
It's one of the best I've ever seen. Because I know I was going on about to Alan Curtis there. I still maintain that Welsh Cup final goal was one of the best I've ever seen, if not the best. But in the context of that was the Champions League final, it was incredible. And he had a point to prove. He was an angry man, wasn't he? You could tell that in his interview afterwards.
Yeah, and then Ronaldo straight afterwards saying how they should rename the cup the CR7 Cup, and how he was deliberately trying to take the attention away from Gareth.
Yeah.
I think Gareth has been unlucky. You know, any other time at Real Madrid or any other club, he'd be the top guy. You could build a team around, because he is a match winner. When I've watched him play for Wales or for Madrid a few times, he can win games single-handedly, and there's not many players that can do that. You know, Ronaldo is one, Messi's another, Maradona is another, but there's very few. You know, Gareth can actually take a game by the scruff of the neck and win it. And I think he's right. He deserves to be playing every week. Some of the Isco, who replaced him, and I know they're grooming him. He's a young guy. They're grooming him to be a Spanish superstar. He's nowhere near Gareth Bale. I can't understand why he starts ahead of Bale. He's nowhere near him. You know.
I think you could sense his frustration, as much as he was injured. He had lost a bit of confidence. But he'd done everything that was asked of him. He'd got really fit again. And critically, he was incredibly confident. And some of those goals he was scoring in the weeks leading up, he was clearly in tremendous form.
Yeah, 5 goals in 4 games up to the final. Everyone thought he'd start because of the form he was in.
Yeah. Except his Classico, of course. Called a beauty.
Except his boss, who, again, I can't believe his boss never spoke to him.
Yeah.
After the game, he scores the winning goal, the winning 2 goals, and his boss, Zinedine Zidane, didn't even approach him, say anything to him. Shocking.
Something's broken down there by the sound of it.
What was quite good as well, Gareth Bale was one of the first people to go up to Loris Karius, the keeper who made those 2 howling errors that cost Liverpool the final. He lay on the floor, and I thought it was, I've got to say, I do think it was disgraceful. No Liverpool player went to him, which I thought
noticeable.
Was shocking.
Yeah.
Bale was one of the first to go up to him and put a hand on his shoulder and say, look, you know, and then the Liverpool coaching staff came over. I thought that was quite staggering. You know? But there we go, that's football for
you. Well, it is, and I mean, God, we could talk for hours on that goalkeeping performance alone. But what strikes me, Jeff, is obviously with your Sky Sports hat on again, is the passion you have for the game. And that really comes across, because Sky Sports on Saturdays, Soccer Saturdays, are a bit of an institution now.
Oh, absolutely.
In a short time, it's become an institution. What is it like to be part of that?
It's incredible, because, again, I get a lot of reaction from that, because it's such a thing that everybody watches in the pubs.
Yeah.
It's a great way to keep up with what's going on, because it was a fantastic idea, this idea to basically put radio on the television, because all they're doing is got 3 guys watching TV, and a bit like Gogglebox, we're watching those 3 ex-footballers watching TV, so you'll see them, they're going, oh, he nearly scored, that was it, and then they'll describe it. Well, what happened there was, you know, he crossed it in from the right, the head at the bar, and you're just watching someone else describing what they've seen on the telly. And then, of course, all along the bottom and down the sides, you've got those statistics, you've got the tables, you've got the latest scores. So you'll know instantly, really quickly, what's happening and how things are changing. And I think they were the first people as well. When they do show the table, the league tables, they update them as the game's going on. Whereas when I was on the BBC, I used to work on Grandstand on the BBC, doing a similar role, reporting football for 8 years. But they would keep the tables the same. So it was only when the game ended they'd update them. But here, if, say, you know, Cardiff City are playing, if they score, then you put Cardiff up in the table where those 3 points would take them.
Right.
And then if the next team equalises, Cardiff dropped where that 1 point would take them.
It did take some getting used to, from my perspective. I've got to say, being an old fart, it did take a bit of getting used to. But now, you think, oh, because you do, naturally, when you are watching these things, you think, well, where would we be if we weren't?
Of course. And keeping those regular updates, and they are, it is very different. As I say, when I was on Grandstand with the BBC, that was a bit more structured. You knew they were the producer, the programme would be coming to you at certain times, so they'd say, right, Jeff's at Cardiff City versus Wrexham, we'll be crossing to Jeff at 5:10 or 3:10. So you knew the first 10 minutes, so you'd prepare a script, you'd watch the opening 10 minutes of the game, and you'd prepare a script, well, Cardiff are on top and Wrexham have done this, and then it crossed you, you know, here's Jeff Collins, and I'd do my little report from a script. Sky Sports News is much more instant. They just want goals, they just want red cards, which means, embarrassingly, if you go to a 0-0 game, often you don't do anything, you feel really bad about it, being paid to do nothing or say nothing. So literally, the winger will go down the wing, you'll cross it in, the centre forward will head into the net, you dial into the studio instantly. You've got no time to prepare or write anything. And the producer will say, or, you know, you tell them who you are. It's Jeff. I'm at, you know, Newport County versus so-and-so. Okay, Jeff, be with you in 2 seconds. You wait, and then Jeff Stelling is straight across to you.
Yeah,
and you've got no time to breathe.
Magic,
yeah, and you've literally got to say, and then you just got to remember what's happened and describe the goal. And try to remember that not everyone is a fan of that team. They won't know who the players are. So I've known some people when they first start, they'll be a bit cryptic. But you've got to explain, you know, who the teams are and make sure you let people know that they play for that team. This team is now scoring the balance of plays here. And, it, you know, it's that technology. The fact that now, within 20 seconds of a goal going in, it's on telly. And there I am telling people on TV what the goal is. Whereas when I first joined the BBC, I remember them saying that it was only 5 or 6 years earlier on film, they used to have two versions of Grandstand. One, where they gave the results. So they say, right, you know, you're joining us today and, you know, Cardiff have beaten Llanelli in rugby and Cardiff City have done this and Swansea City have done that. There's the results. Tune in tomorrow for the goals. And what they do is they process the film overnight.
Yeah.
And then the next day you tuned in to watch the goals because they just couldn't get the film ready in time for that show. And that's only, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years. It's not that long.
Technology.
Whereas now, certain shows on BT and on Sky, they will show the goals as they happen. I know, when, for example, when I was watching I was in a pub watching the Cardiff City Fulham game, the Cardiff City Reading game at the end of the season. And of course, they're crossing to Birmingham to show the Fulham goal, while it's still going on. It's incredible. So
I guess for contractual reasons, they can't do that with the Premier League, but for the Championship, they will just show the goals as they go. They can't do it on a Saturday, it doesn't seem to me. But certainly midweek they can.
It's incredible, the technology. And I think, you know, what with social media as well, everything's so instant now. I was saying to someone the other day, you know, everybody would wait for CFAX to know what the Wales rugby team was, or the Wales football team, or the Lions announcement. You wait, you'd get it on CFAX first, and then you'd have to wait for the paper, the South Wales Echo or something.
Yeah.
Whereas now, everyone's poised on their favourite website, and as soon as that team is announced, if they say they're going to announce the Wales team to face the All Blacks on Thursday midday, there it is on social media at 12 o'clock when they say, and you get it in instantly.
So how is that as a journalist then? How has that affected your job?
Well, it has changed everything because now people expect things. Before, you know, if you had, if you were at a, when I was in London working for the likes of Sky and ITN, for example, and LBC, you might be at a court case. Now you knew that the next bulletin isn't for another hour.
Yeah.
And there's no other way of getting, you know, back in the 90s, early 2000s, there's no other way of getting stuff out there. So if I knew that someone had been convicted of murder, I knew I had 50 minutes to get that on air so I could stroll out of the court. You go into the radio van, you write your report up, you voice up, and then they say, well, actually, we might get Frank Both from LBC to do an interview with you, but that'll be at 10 to 1. And you had plenty of time, and nobody else was going to beat you to it. You know, radio would always get it first, because you had bulletins on the hour, but again, TV, you knew you had till 6 in the evening.
Yeah,
if you've missed the lunchtime news, you had all afternoon to do that. Whereas now, of course, literally the moment, you know, the last two jobs in particular I had were social media impacted. When I was news editor of National Radio, but also six other radio stations across South Wales. We had Bay FM or Bay Radio in Swansea. We had Bridge FM in Bridgend, Scarlet FM in Llanelli, three stations in West Wales, Carmarthen Radio, Radio Pembrokeshire and Radio Ceredigion. And, you know, anything that happened, it needed to be out there instantly. Because if I decided not to go on our social media pages, our Twitter, our Facebook, and put it out there, somebody else would beat us to it.
Yeah.
And then I was going to say your boss, but I was the boss. But you have to explain to people, why is it taking us half an hour to get this thing out there?
Yeah.
And actually, Capital Radio and Heart FM, they had it half an hour ago. And people would now judge that. So whereas before, when I first started on radio, people would tape other people's bulletins. Our news editor, when I was in the Midlands or London, you'd record the BBC and he'd listen to that bulletin back and say, right, our bulletin didn't have X story on, but they did Y. And you'd judge yourself with that. Now it's social media. We'd have people saying, oh, did you hear Capital Radio on their Twitter feed? They're saying this, but we don't seem to have that.
Yeah.
And so suddenly everything had to be instantaneous. And also, you also had to do Facebook Lives and little videos for Twitter. So suddenly you were, and on TV as well, you're suddenly preparing little video snippets to go out on social media. If you're waiting, and again, I guess when you're waiting for an interview, because sometimes, you know, you might be at a story that's a big event and there's loads of press there. For example, if the First Minister was announcing something and you might be in a queue, so maybe the BBC get the first interview, Channel 4 get the second interview, you've got the third one, but there's still people behind you. So while you're waiting, you can now do a little little Facebook Live report. You can click on Facebook Live, do the report. I'm here at the assembly. This is what's happening. Send
you
it.
See the first Munster in the back being
exactly.
interviewed. Yeah, so you get
so,
a flavour of quickly.
So all of a sudden, you now tend to get the basic news out very quickly on social media. So you get the nub of the story, because it's all very short and very brief. So you'll tell people, you know, like a good example is when the First Minister announced that Aston Martin were coming to South Wales and there'd be loads of jobs. So you'd put up a little 6-second clip of him explaining it, maybe a little Facebook Live report, and that would be out instantly. But then you had the rest of the day to put together the more considered report for the more traditional outlets on radio and TV. So it becomes, you know, get it out quick on social media, then take time sculpting the piece for TV and radio. So it's kind of added to the pressures of radio and TV,
But so for sort of listeners who aren't aware, summarise your sort of news broadcast career.
Yeah, well, basically, I think I started off, I was a very big news fan as a kid, and my dream was to work for ITN. Another dream of mine was also to present international football and rugby on TV or radio. Yeah. Those were my little dreams as a child, you know. And so, I was a big news fan. So when I started out, it was mainly focusing on news. So my first job, I got in the Midlands. I was on Merseysound in Coventry and BRNB in Birmingham as a newsreader and reporter, BRNB a chief reporter. Although I nearly didn't get the first job at Merseysound. My news editor was a great chap, taught me so much. Colin Palmer was a fantastic journalist. Just taught me, you know, most of what I know. Really sharp guy. Very thick. Brummy accent. So So I'd sent off a speculative letter.
Yeah.
And he wrote back saying, rang back saying, "You've applied a bit late for this job. Why is that?" And I said, "Well, I didn't know there was a job going. I was just a speculative letter leaving college." He said, "Oh, well, I'm just about to write to the guy who's got the job here, but come and see me anyway." So I spoke to my tutor and said, "Look, should I go for this? It sounds like he's already got someone." And the guy said, "Well, yeah, go. It'll be good interview experience."
Yeah.
So I went up there, and of course, the first question you're expecting, you know, why do you want to be a journalist, or, you know, what is it about journalism that appeals to you? And he said something to me, and I had no idea what it was. And I just looked at him, and I was like, "Oh, I'm ever so sorry. Could you repeat that?" And he repeated it, and I just looked at him again, like, "I'm really sorry. I've got no idea what you said." And this happened. I had to ask him four times.
Geez.
And then on the fifth time, he just mimed a rugby ball and said, "Do you play oval ball or round ball?" Luckily, by the end, we'd chatted, we'd had such fun and gone so well, I got the job, luckily. So I had a grounding in radio journalism as a reporter and newsreader on BRNB and Merseysound. And then I got a job on Classic FM, the first ever national commercial radio station. Before then, it had only been the BBC. The BBC had the only national radio stations.
Yeah.
And they advertised three, didn't they? The one that won the first licence was called Showtime, and it was basically going to play vaudeville tunes. Now, even back in the 90s, who listens to vaudeville? So that died a death quite early on. They gave the licence back. Classic FM won it again. I think Virgin won the second, and then Talk Radio won the third one.
Yeah.
So we launched first, and it was good to be part of history. It really felt like you were being part of history. And I think, you know, it was such a big thing. They basically decided to be a bit different to Radio 3. Radio 3 would play whole operas, whole symphonies. They decided to play snippets of things based on what Mozart did. They were saying when Mozart played concerts, he'd play a greatest hits, little snippets of his stuff, and also little snippets of other composers' stuff. So that was their idea. And whereas Radio 3 at the time, in the early 90s, ran on £36 million a year, Classic FM ran on 12, and they made it within 2 or 3 months. They had Barclay sponsored The Weather for £1 million, Cross and Blackall sponsored Nicky Horn's show for £1 million, W.H. Smith sponsored Paul Gambaccini doing the chart show for £2 million.
Yeah.
So they got the £12 million really quickly. And then they franchised it. They basically decided after 2 years, they realised that, you know, having overheads such as studios was expensive. So they drew up this like McDonald's type franchise pack where they told companies, these are the jingles you play, these are the songs you kind of play, this is how you present it and how you... And they sold it to Finland, so they had Classic FM Finland, Classic FM Australia, Classic FM Austria. They sold 16 of these packs at £10 million each, and I think it was 2% of their revenue for life.
Yeah.
So they had a really good franchise.
So as long as they met certain criteria, they could
They won this franchise. Yeah, they could pay for this franchise, but they wouldn't let it to people who they thought might abuse the Classic FM name. As I said, they were trying to appeal to the populist. They were trying to make classical music more populist, not so elitist, which gave them a bit of a dilemma. The first ever competition they ran, it was for a car. I can't remember what it could have been, a Nissan or a Toyota. I can't remember what car it was. And as I say, so they're aiming at the populist masses.
Yeah.
And the first winner was the Defence Secretary, Sir George Younger, in the back of his chauffeur-driven government limo he won. And they actually had this big debate. Look, should we maybe not let him win? Because it's going to look bad. If we say that our first winner is a government cabinet minister, this is looking bad.
Now he's wearing micro.
Yeah, and so in the end, they said, look, he did win it. We can't fiddle this.
Yeah.
We're just going to have to go with it, even if it is bad publicity. And I think it was Henry Kelly. Remember him from like Going for Gold
indeed,
and all that?
Yeah.
He used to always remind us all the time that he used to be the political editor on the Irish Times. He was a lovely chap. But I remember him saying, look, we've got to be fair. We've got to be honest. And he said, well, we should have a mix of listeners. We can have the elite listeners. We can have the working class. He said, we don't need to just target one. He said, let's tell them. Let Sir George Younger win. So he did. Had a great time there. Then I kind of left and I went freelance in London. So I worked for ITN and Sky for about 3 years on Sky News on Sunrise, which was great fun with Bob Friend, the presenter at the time. Doing lots of stuff for ITN and also for Channel 4. If you remember The Big Breakfast.
I do indeed.
I used to do the news on that. So for Phil Gale would present it, I'd write the news. And it was quite short, you know, and I'd voice up all the Premier League stuff as well when I was doing that. But yeah, it was very hard getting. Remember Phil Gale, they used to have the little three-word headlines above his shoulder.
Yes.
They were very difficult. It's like being the.
That's the skill.
Yeah, the sub-editor of The Sun. You know, yeah. The Sun used to be one of those snappy.
Yeah, headlines. Yeah.
And my favourite was when Glenn Hoddle quit, and my headline above Phil Gale's shoulder was, I've hod enough, which I was very proud of at the time, immensely proud of. So, so I had a great 3 years.
Yeah.
I worked for another station called Bloomberg, who are a financial TV company, basically like Sky Sports News, little financial details.
Yeah.
So I did a bit of work with them where I learned to film and edit my own stuff. And then I came back to BBC Wales. They were looking for, you know, normally, because I was working in news, and I'd only ever worked in news for that first 10 years in London and in the Midlands. And BBC Wales were looking for a news journalist to join their sports team to make their sports team more newsy, because they'd missed a few stories. Jonathan Davis had gone to rugby league, but their commentators decided it wasn't a story. And they were missing all the stories to ITV and the newspapers.
Why would they have missed stories like that? Because that just seems incredible.
What they were saying is their sports team at the time were commentators. They were very events-based.
Yeah.
So they would do the commentary on a game. But, for example, when Jonathan Davis went north, or I remember Scott Gibbs injuring his knee, our best player, out for a year with a knee injury, and the commentators decided it wasn't a story. Or just that, I just don't think they were linked to news, or they had a mindset to let the news team know. Yeah, so Scott Gibbs is injured, but you know, they weren't really thinking about other outlets. So the people in sport who were the boss at the time, Arthur Emyer, Hamish Stewart, who's one of the senior producers, who's a great chap. They were looking for something newsy, and they did say to me, when my CV dropped on the table and they saw, you know, I'd worked at ITN and Sky and LBC, they thought, this is the chat for us, even before the interview. Because I was very tired for that interview. I was working at ITN on the overnight news, I started at 10 in the night, I finished at 9 in the morning. The editor let me go at 6. I drove to Cardiff, having done this whole shift overnight, parked in the chapter car park, got changed into a suit, went to BBC Wales in London, and I just don't remember the interview at all. I was so tired.
Yeah.
I have no idea how it went. But on the way back, I rang from the motorway, and they told me I'd got it.
Yeah.
And as I said, I since found out it was pretty much mine.
So
because
you didn't really have
different.
To think about it, I suppose.
No, and then the idea was, well, they were starting a new digital channel called BBC Choice Wales, and it was going to be the first digital channel in the world. The Astra satellite for Sky was going up on October the 1st in 1998, and the BBC started transmitting a week early, just internally, but at least it meant for the Guinness Book of Records, they got the first ever digital channel. And BBC launched a news programme, so basically for sport. So our sports team, rather than the Wales Today news team, we did about 40 minutes a night. We did a 25-minute news show at 7 o'clock, and then we'd come back at 11 o'clock to update. So if there are any football games on, we could say, you know, we told you earlier Cardiff City were playing X, this is the result.
Yeah.
So we could update people, or we could let them know about any transfer news. So we did about 40 minutes of news on TV, and it was the first time BBC Sport had done TV news. And so it was a big thing. So I was there for that. I was there for about 8 years in the end. BBC Choice stopped in about 2001 and became BBC Three, because the BBC had a bit of a change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then what they did is they relaunched us as BBC 2W, which was the digital BBC Two. And it was great. I had a great time there. I thought I had some great personal highlights. I went there and I found out that, you know, we weren't editing our stuff in-house. We're editing it across the road in Llandaff and the Pyramid Building here.
Yeah.
And it was just ridiculous getting pieces back, walking down the road. So I persuaded them to you know, bring that back in-house to our studio behind. And we forged greater relationships with the news team at the time. Jason Muhammad and Claire Summers on news, and Bob Humphries, who I used to love. But Bob Humphries was a great chap. Going so well with him. And they used to do news pieces, and the sports team would do news pieces. We'd both do separate pieces.
Yeah.
And I just thought, given where I'd come from at ITM, this was crazy. And I managed to persuade the head of the news team there, Mark O'Callaghan, we'd have a chat with a few people, and we and Bob Humphries as well, and we persuaded them to let sport do some of the sports news. So if there was a big thing on, Rob Phillips or myself or someone else in sport would do it, and the news team wouldn't have to revoice it or redo it at all. So it forged better working relationships between news and sport, because it had been a bit territorial before I joined there. They were quite, you know, sport would try and get one up over news happens, and news would get one up over sport.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. So as I said, so I spent about 8 years there, and then basically I left to go freelance for a bit on Swansea Sound. So I spent about 2 years on Swansea Sound reading the news, just enjoying being freelance. Mm-hmm. Before the next big thing, I came back here to Cardiff to be based at the ITN's ITV Wales studios for Nation Radio, because as I say, it's a big group of 7 radio stations, and I was the news editor there, so I was reading the news, doing lots of reporting, and also in my spare in between the news buttons, we did 2 sports shows called Football Nation and Rugby Nation. Rugby Nation I co-presented with Sean Holly, the former Ospreys and Bristol coach, who's doing Scrum 5 at the moment.
Yeah.
We won a Sony Award for that, for best. We got the bronze Sony Award, which is like a radio Oscar for best sports show. And that's so dominated by the BBC. You know, only 5 of the 90 awards were commercial radio won.
Yeah.
And the group I was in, we hadn't been nominated in 20-odd years or ever, I don't think. I think our group, in its 25-year existence, had never been nominated. So they were so chuffed that we were just nominated for best sports show, that to actually get bronze, we were all delighted. So I really enjoyed doing those 2 sports shows on Nation and the news. And then the last thing I did, we had a call from... a very big guy in media who's run loads of sort of TV production companies, as a very big guy in media in Wales, Bryn Roberts. He called me up, and Hugh Owens from BBC Wales was part of it, and they were launching a new local TV station called Made in Cardiff TV. So they asked me to be the news editor and also to present the main news bulletins on Made in Cardiff as well. And we had a great 2 years doing that. The first 2 years, it was fantastic, you know. And we had links with the BBC. We'd actually provide stories to the BBC in return for a sort of nominal payment. We had to send them 4 or 5 stories a day. And that really helped the BBC as well, I think, manage their cameras. And they could cover extra stories because they knew we'd be doing stuff in Cardiff. And it was a fantastic 2 years. And we really connected with the people of Cardiff. At one stage, we had, you know, 160,000 viewers a week. The news had 100,000 viewers. And people were stopping me. I was being stopped in the streets on a daily basis by people saying, you know, we've watched this, you know, not just me, but we've watched your programmes. We love this programme, we love that cookery show, you know, we love the sports show. And it was really making inroads. Mm. And that was a really pleasurable time of my life, I think.
Well, I mean, that's where our paths first crossed in Made in Cardiff, going on the newspaper review and all that. And you're right, Ben. I was amazed how many people said to me, oh, I saw you on Made in Cardiff, you know, it did have a reach, didn't it?
Well, really, funny enough, I remember the council leader at the time, Phil Bale, we used to get on quite well, and I remember him saying to me once that he got more feedback from Made in Cardiff than he did from the council's official. He said, I'm always getting people coming up saying, I think the one example he used was when they created the hub in Clinician by the police station. So they turned that into the Cardiff Council hub, where you can get all the facilities and all the services.
Yeah.
And he said, I've had so many people come see, I saw that in Made in Cardiff, that Legend Hub. That's a really good idea. He said, I'm getting so much feedback from Made in Cardiff, you know. So.
And now that's all changed again, isn't it? Because they haven't.
BBC
money has stopped, right?
I think the BBC money stopped, which, you know, I don't think they had the sales team right. I think the team from Leeds, at first, they didn't get the right salespeople in Cardiff, and there were a lot of people who weren't making any sales. And of course, you need to make sales, because that's what pays for the station.
Yeah.
So they were relying on some Welsh government money and the BBC money initially, and the investors' money, because there were a lot of wealthy people behind Made TV who were pumping millions into it. So we were relying on that too much, I think. And then I thought the BBC might renew its contract, because as I say, we were supplying 4 to 5 stories a day. So for 2 years when I was there, they knew they didn't have to go to the Cardiff Devils, Cardiff Blues or Cardiff City Football Club to cover their press conferences, because we were there, we filmed them, we sent them to the BBC, so they could send those 3 cameras elsewhere and help cover more things for Wales. And I thought it worked as a good relationship. But of course, they're not happy having to supply BBC licence payers money to support and prop up S4C.
Yeah.
They certainly didn't want to prop up us and lose a bit more money.
Yeah.
So I think money is the key issue. So, sadly...
What was it like setting up that kind of operation when news is changing so quickly, you know, technologically, on all aspects, news is changing rapidly.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to sort of, you know, almost like jumping on a conveyor belt, aren't you?
In a sense, it's easy. I've been very lucky. In my career, I've set up 4 radio stations and 2 TV stations. I was involved in setting up BBC Choice, although because of the BBC infrastructure, I wasn't as actually involved in the groundwork as so much as I was in Made in Cardiff. And then the 4 radio stations, Classic FM, Sunshine Radio in Herefordshire and Worcestershire, ITN's News Direct, LBC's relaunch. So those things, like I said, I remember on Sunshine, you know, having to find premises in Hereford and Monmouthshire for both studios, and we had to recruit staff, we had to find equipment, we had to organise the transmitters, and it took us 18 months. It was a lot of work. Now, with Made in Cardiff, it was a lot quicker, primarily because, like we were hinting too early about the social media, because the technology's got better, it makes it easier. Mm. Suddenly, the cameras you're buying are a lot cheaper and a lot quicker. So the auto cue and the cameras were very simple to buy. We did a deal with a Russian company called Megahertz, and they supplied a lot of the equipment. And the gallery, now I remember when I was on BBC Choice, I think the gallery there, it cost millions, and it was a hugely impressive gallery. The one we had at Made in Cardiff was, again, equally impressive, but I think it just cost a few tens of thousands because the technology had come down in price. Yeah. That suddenly we had all these monitors and all the equipment that you need to run a TV station. But again, instead of spending millions, it was tens of thousands because the technology was much more...
Technology changes. Yeah. Kind of democratized things to a degree, hasn't they?
So that made things a lot easier, in a sense. And again, the same with editing. When I joined BBC Wales in 98, you had to have an editor sitting at a £1 million editing desk with all those buttons,
about
50,
buttons.
50 faders, which no one knew what they did.
Yeah.
And then suddenly... Made in Cardiff, I'm sitting in front of a computer editing my own pieces with the new digital software that allows you to edit TV and radio, and you pay a few £1,000 a year for it. So suddenly, you know, we didn't need to. I think we had one room with one proper editor in because her name was Rhiann George. She's a very talented young girl, and she would edit our main shows. So the shows that needed the really finesse on the really good work. And she was called a craft editor, so she put all the, you know, that just made the shows look amazing. Whereas some of the more news and current affairs show we could do ourselves and just keep them quite basic. So we had one editing suite where she would do that, but the rest of us were just editing on laptops and on computers. And that changing technology actually made it quite... Was I can imagine setting up a TV station 15 years earlier would have been a much different proposition.
Through the roof, investment-wise.
Yeah, absolutely, gosh.
But I mean... I really want to talk about music, but we could talk about news for hours. But it's still fantastically popular with students. That, you know, people still want, you know, journalism remains a really popular course. People want to break into the media. What is it? Why is that? I think I know why, but I'd love you to explain to the listeners why you think that is, and also what advice would you give to someone who was just coming out of university now or doing their MA in journalism? What would be your advice?
I must admit, I don't envy them now, because certainly when I came out, there were only 4 or 5 postgraduate courses. There were no journalism degrees. And so you did your degree, you did your postgraduate if you were determined enough. And it was all about enthusiasm and determination and people who really wanted to do it, rather than people who just thought... There were a lot of people who wanted to do journalism because they were doing, say, English and history, and then they thought, what can I do? Oh, I can write. I'll be a journalist. And they were the ones who was fell by the wayside, and it was the ones who really loved news and loved that kind of programme. I mean, I applied 2 years before my course, 2 years before I finished my degree, and 3 of the 4 postgraduate courses all wrote back to me saying, you know, are you an idiot? You've applied 2 years too early. and only one, the most prestigious one, London College of Printing, wrote back to me and said, we're going to give an interview on October the 17th in 2 years' time, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And they were just looking for that enthusiasm. And what I would say to people is just to be determined, you know, approach places, approach newspapers, radio, TV, do some work experience, because the more you see and the more you learn, that does help you. But just be persistent, because actually, you know, persistence does pay off. One thing I would say, as things get more popular, it's like if you want to be an actor or a rock star, and I think journalism is becoming like this. I found on Nation Radio, and again, when I think I missed out a little bit, when we're talking about my career, I think I missed out a bit when I was in Hereford and Monmouthshire doing Sunshine Radio for 3 years. You know, we launched that radio station. I was the group news editor there as well as doing the rock show for 7 years. Forgot about that. Yeah, so I was group news editor of 9 radio stations in Yorkshire, the West Country, and Herefordshire and Telford. And that was the first time where I started getting letters from young journalists saying, I left college a year or two ago and I've never worked in journalism. Can't get a job. I'm working in the bar. And in Nation Radio, one of the journalists we took on, Katie Evans, she worked in a bar and joined us, her first job from college after quite a while, and then left us for a bit to go back to working in a bar because it paid more than radio journalism. Luckily, she came back to
us. You've got
to
want it, haven't you?
And I think that's it. That's the key. And I think... But there's now much more people than when I started who want to be in there. So you're fighting against many more people, like being a rock star, like being a footballer. Or so I think you've just got to be, a little bit of it is being in the right place at the right time. I hate to, it is. I must admit, in some of my jobs, I guess that's the same for me. You know, I've applied for certain things. I think the BBC job, when they're looking normally, they'd have taken a sports journalist. You wouldn't look at someone from the news. Why would you? You wouldn't cross someone over. They'd have looked at my application and said, "He's a news guy. We're sport.
Yeah.
Right place, right time." I think made in Cardiff. Again, I think I was just right time, right place for that. So I think there is a little bit of luck in there.
Yeah.
But if you're persistent, you make your own luck to a degree. Yeah. If you're constantly applying for jobs, and with that work experience, if you are going to places like IDV Wales, BBC Wales, Nation Radio, Capital Heart, and you're putting your face around, then people do remember you. Yeah. And if you're constantly in, as long as you're not too pushy and aggressive, you know, which. You can be overly pushy and aggressive and put people off you. But if you're just there and about and getting your name known, and people know that you're good and you're reliable and you're consistent. Because, again, the one thing I've always said, when people are being interviewed for jobs, one of the things that does help is if you are known in a degree, because I always know that if you've got 4 candidates for a job, 2 of them could have Oxbridge degrees and be really high-flying. But if you don't know them, what if one of them's a bit violent and a bit aggressive, or the other's a bit annoying, say, maybe? But then the third guy, you've worked with him. A year ago, you worked with him at another radio station, and you know, top chap, really reliable, very funny, enjoyable to get along with. He's got the job. Because you know him and you can trust him. Whereas the other two, even if they do a better interview, you're still thinking, well, you know, they could turn out to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
So sometimes, and that's the same with work experience. If you're that first entry level job, if you've got 4 or 5 new students and they look at them and they say, well, they all look really good, but then there's one girl and maybe she's, you know, done work experience with you for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
6 months ago, you're going to say, oh, actually, she was really good, I liked her.
That can give you an edge, can't it?
Absolutely can. So I would always say, be persistent, keep just dropping in places, keep, you know, volunteering, and keep your name known, absolutely.
That's really good advice, Jeff. We do really need to talk about music, because that's one of your many hats. Is A, you've got your own radio show, which a lot of people aspire to, but also you've written 2 very well received books as well. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. I do a radio. As I say, when I started that radio station in Monmouthshire and Herefordshire, Sunshine Radio, in 2007, the last ever FM license. It's DAB only after that one.
Right.
And so we won that. And I did a rock show for 7 years on that, which was really well received. Then recently, the last year and a bit, I've been doing rock show for Hard Rock Hell Radio, an internet radio station, who are run by this group of festivals. They started off, it's my favourite festival, so I'm chuffed to be working for them. You know, 10 years ago, I remember going to their first festival in Prestatyn in North Wales, sponsored by Classic Rock Magazine and Metal Hammer.
Yeah.
And it's a classic rock festival. It took off, so about 6,000 people turn up there and stay in the caravans and the chalets and watch a weekend of great music. And it took off so well, they've now got classic prog and classic blues and classic AOR, and they've got the Metal Hammer Festival. So they've got about 12 festivals now. There's one in Ibiza, one in Scotland, and so they've now decided to have their own radio station. So I enjoy doing that every week. And then with the books, I was writing for my favourite magazine, Classic Rock Magazine. I started writing some articles for them, and I started doing quite a few. Some musicians started telling me about Rockville Studios, which as a kid, I'd been very intrigued by these studios just outside Cardiff in Monmouth, where Queen wrote Bohemian Rhapsody and Zeppelin and Robert Plant and Deep Purple, not Deep Purple, Motorhead, you know, all these bands were there. I couldn't understand. I think Rush did their first albums outside Canada, here in South Wales. I couldn't understand what was it about this place.
The name kept popping up, didn't it?
Yeah, you see it on the back of albums, which, of course, if you're just downloading stuff today.
You used to read the album covers and sleeves.
You don't see that now.
No.
So I started writing some articles on it, and I thought, you know what? I was going to write an article for Classic Magazine. I got so many stories, I thought this would make a good book. So I approached the University of Wales Press, who were really intrigued by the idea. So they signed me up for a 5-book deal. And I approached the guy who ran Rockfield, and he said, "Oh, I get approached every few weeks. So many people want to write a book on Rockfield. It never happens." And I won't talk about the bands. He said, "Look, bands get up to stuff here. If I spill the beans, they'll never come. Yeah. So I can't tell you any stories." And I said to him, "Well, look, I don't need you to tell me stories. All the bands are telling me stuff already, and I told him who I'd spoken to." I said, "But when they're describing things, I just need to know the layout of the place. And also, when I'm describing in the book, I'm going to need to know the layout. So can I have a look around?" So he gave me a guided tour. And yeah, it was great. I had the lead singer of Rush ring me at home, Geddy Lee. And that was one of my, being a big Rush fan, to answer the phone and if, "Hi, is Jeff Collins there?" I said, "Yeah." "Hi, this is Geddy Lee from Rush." And I was like, "Oh." And the record company had warned me, you know, normally they say, "Expect a call from so-and-so." They'd forgotten to do that. So I was just at home getting this phone call.
Did you play it cool? Or were you
I think I played it coolish.
Yeah.
There might have been a big pause where I was going, "It's Geddy Lee from Rush." And I kind of got to meet Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin. That was a weird one because I remember I was so desperate to get that interview. He did his first three solo albums after Zeppelin there, and he moved there. And he had, you know, Jason Bonham, John Bonham's son, as a drummer, Phil Collins and Cozy Powell. Yeah. He had a good band there. And his keyboard player, I'll tell you about his keyboard player in a minute, who was amazing. And I was so desperate to secure the interview. So I rang Robert Plant. I said, "Look, can we do this interview, say, you know, at your home in the West Country? West Midlands, you know, in Dudley." "Oh, I'm never in the Black Country anymore. Hardly ever there." "Okay, how about your home in London?" "Oh, never there. I was like, "Right, again. What about your home in West Wales?" "Oh, I'm rarely there." And I'm now thinking, there's no way I can get to his home in New York or the Bahamas.
Yeah.
No one's going to pay for that.
No.
So I'm suddenly thinking, "Oh, maybe I'm just going to have to do it on the phone," which would be a bit of a shame.
Yeah.
And then he suggested himself. He said, "Well, look, why don't we go to Rockfield Studios, where we did it?" Because he obviously has a great affinity with Monmouth. And I'd arranged for his solo band to be there, apart from Phil Collins, who was in New York writing Tarzan. But he sent me some answers by email and sent me a message for Robert as well. And so I said to him, "Well, if you get there on May the 13th, I've got the rest of your band there." So Robert was like, "Oh, fantastic." So the whole band turned up for a reunion. They hadn't seen each other for a while. Robbie Blunt, a great guitarist. The keyboard player, Jez Woodruff, was a legend. He's such a star. He'd only played for two bands. His dad used to run a keyboard shop in Birmingham, and he'd played for a few local bands. And then one day, Ozzy Osbourne walked into the keyboard shop and spoke to us. "Look, do you mind, you know, do you fancy joining Black Sabbath?" So he joined Black Sabbath, age 19, for their Technical Ecstasy album in 1970, mid-70s. And he said it was amazing. He said, you know, they flew me out to Florida to the Criteria Studios, and he was explaining how Black Sabbath were in the middle studio, and they had the Eagles to the left of them doing Hotel California, and Fleetwood Mac to the right of them doing Rumours.
He's a 19-year-old kid plucked out of the shop.
Exactly, into this. And he said I was on the pool side, and he said I had Mick Fleetwood come up to me with a tape recorder playing You Can Go Your Own Way, saying, "Do you think this is a single?" He's there listening to, you know, "You Can Go Your Own Way." He said, "Is this a single, do you think?" And he said, "I'm 19 or 20. And then he said, the next night at the bar, there's Don Henley playing him the opening to Hotel California, saying, "Do you think this is too long?" And he's like, "You're asking me?"
What did this 19-year-old kid have that they went, or was it just the atmosphere they were in and they were just running stuff by
He was a very good keeper. So he said, you know, the only two bands he ever played for, Sabbath and Robert Plant.
He could have changed the face of history.
Well, yeah.
History, couldn't he? Could have said to Don Henley, "Nah, cut it down, mate.
Yeah. Have a keyboard intro."
Yeah, that's what we need. Yeah.
So he was funny. So I got to meet Lemmy as well, because Lemmy had recorded at Rockfield with Hawkwind and Motorhead. Mm. He had a load of funny stories. When I first interviewed him, he was playing a one-armed bandit backstage at Cardiff University, and I was saying to him, "Oh, are you winning?" I was like, "Nah, it's my own money." He just used to take it with him and play with it to relax himself. And he insisted that I had a shot of JD after every question, me and him together. He said, "I'm not answering, we've got to do that." So because I had to ask him about two bands, I was a bit hazy when I left the interview. I was coming back that night because he made us do that. But he was great, you know.
I've read a few interviews with Lemmy, and he's obviously a genuine rock legend. Mm. Just sounded terrifying to me. What was he like?
He was lovely. He was very nice. And I said, I found most of them are. Another, when I did the Stuart Cable book afterwards, I wrote another book about Stuart Cable. Most people who've read the two books, the Rock Legends of Rockfield and the Stuart Cable book, say they read like radio documentaries, surprisingly, given what I do.
Yeah.
And it was more about my journey. The Rockfield book, I think the first chapter starts with me driving to Rockfield, listening to these songs on the radio that were made there. And it's kind of like my discovery of, you know, what made it such a famous studio. And the same with the Stuart Cable book. It wasn't his biography. It was my journey, starting with his new band, Kinley for Company, who were brilliant. Could he make them as big as the Stereophonics? So we start off where they're doing a headline gig at the Point in Cardiff, and I'm introducing them on stage. And then we go back in time, and Stuart talks about the Stereophonics, and then we leap back to the current day with Kinley for Company, and they're supporting The Who at the Liberty Stadium, the first ever gig of any kind at the Liberty Stadium. And I think, and The Who's stage manager, tour manager, persuaded me to introduce all three bands. He said, look, you can't, Killing for Company can't just go out on stage. It's the first ever gig here. Someone's got to introduce you. So Stuart was saying, well, Jeff did it last week at the Point. And they pushed me out into the stage in front of Roger Daltrey's microphone. It wasn't quite full. It was beginning of the day, but there's still about 15,000-20,000 people there, and I had to introduce all three bands, which was very nerve-wracking. But great fun.
What an honour, yeah.
As soon as I came off the bass playing, he said, oh, he said, that's major name, Jeff. He said, that'll be a Trivial Pursuit question. Who was the first voice heard at the Liberty Stadium in the first gig there? I was like, no, I don't think it will be. But they had a good... But Stuart knew Roger Daltrey really well, because him and the Stereophonics used to do a lot of work for the... Daltrey's cancer charity gig every year at the Albert Hall, and the Stereophonics always did stuff, always donated stuff, and so he became quite good friends with Daltrey. And when he started Killing for Company, he sent Daltrey, I didn't know Daltrey had heard about it, and asked, oh, can you send me some stuff, I want to hear it. And he then personally invited Stuart and the band on to support The Who in Swansea. So I spent the whole week tracking down Roger Daltrey, and that was a lovely interview as well. I was told, he's a busy man, we're going to leave as soon as the gig's over, you've got 10 minutes with him. So I did this 10-15 minute interview with Roger Daltrey, and then he kept me there. We couldn't leave. He kept me there for about an hour talking music.
Yeah.
His knowledge of music is amazing. We were just chatting about music for about an hour, and then someone came and said, oh, time to go. And I just find that some of the more famous musicians, like Lemmy, like Daltrey, like Plant, are so comfortable in themselves. And I think another one, David Coverdale of Whitesnake. Yeah. Again, when I interviewed him, we had a lovely chat, and when I met him, he was saying, you know, you're from Sunshine Radio. I said, yeah. He said, in Britain, that should be pissing down with Rain FM. And he was telling me all these stories about, you know, his new house in Lake Tahoe, and he just had three bears invade his property. Two got trapped in the pool, and the third was wandering around. They had to call a ranger to get it out. And again, he was so friendly, so lovely. Because I think I said to him, one of my questions was, talking about early Whitesnake and how it's changed into the current Whitesnake, you know, and did time feel like it had gone quickly? You know, was it like entering a wormhole, we've gone suddenly from, you know, the early days. Time has passed here. And he just looked at wormhole. He said, I love that, what a great word. He said, next time I check into a hotel, I'm going to sign myself in as Ernest Wormhole. I just find they are very comfortable and relaxed.
Yeah.
And whereas I must have, like when I did the lead singer of Judas Priest, Rob Halford, I'd heard he had quite a formidable reputation. But they're all lovely. They all treat you like you're their best mate. They've only met you once or twice, but the way they talk to you, it's like you're their best pal.
Yeah.
Whereas sometimes, and it hasn't happened often, but some of the younger bands coming up, maybe they feel they've got to be a bit aggressive and shirty, because I find they're the ones who are most disrespectful. I remember one band called Highly Suspect, I think they're called, and they were added to a bill at the Motor Point, and it was a headline bill, three bands headlining. It was Shinedown, Hailstorm and Blackstone Cherry, who are three really big up-and-coming bands from America. And I interviewed each member of the band. Blackstone Cherry in particular are all lovely because they come from a tiny town in America of 800 people. So they're always amazed that every gig they play, there's more people than the place they live.
Yeah.
And they're so sweet. And I'd interviewed this guy, Ben Wells, so many times. Again, he was a lovely chap. And the other two bands, likewise, the people I interviewed were really accommodating and friendly. But then the new band, and you could hear them arguing backstage, we don't want to do the interview, we've been up all night, we've only just got in. And then when they brought the lead singer out, it was one-word answers, and the way he was looking away all the time. You could tell he didn't want to be there. And that's the only times I've ever had people, you know, behave like... Well, as you said, you'd assume that maybe the superstars would be a bit, oh, have I really got to do this again? But most of them know that it's what the fans are what's made them famous, and actually, they've got to still relate to these people. And if they don't, it could all be cut off in an instant. You know, yes, Judas Priest and Whitesnake and all this, they're still riding high, but, you know, it could be cut off in an instant, and then where would they be? So
this really chimes with on this show, I interviewed Ashley Todd from Spillers, who owned Spillers, and she was saying Robert Plant came into the shop one afternoon, he was in town doing his thing with Alison Krauss, and she said he was just a total gentleman, came in, flicking through the records, was asking questions, the politest guy ever. You know, there were blokes of a certain age just sort of frozen in their tracks. And she said he was the most charming guy ever. But she said she like yourself, because they would have bands playing in the shop on occasion.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes it would be the up and coming ones who felt they had to give a bit of attitude and were a bit rude. But then that soon went, you know. I don't know, it's a funny thing. I think the comfort in their own skin is the big one there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you know you're a huge star and you know that everything you do turns to gold, then, you don't need to be bullshit, you know.
Is it as well, though, if you're that famous, people are always coming to you with a smile on their face, or they're generally being pretty nice to you. Is that part of it as well?
I don't know, it could be. I guess. But I'm not. But then again, you know, you do get some people constantly saying, you know, some of the older bands and the bigger stars are dinosaurs and they need to be replaced by younger stars. So maybe they get that too, but I guess they judge. I guess if they judge if someone's being a bit of an idiot or deliberately having a go at them, they probably clam up and stop doing it. But I think if they know, you know, someone's just there to help them and, you know, help promote them, and it's not, you know, vital to the world, you know, you're just doing an interview to promote a bit of music.
Well, but it's nice to meet your heroes as well. It's that old cliche, you should never meet them.
Yeah.
But it's nice to think that.
Well,
that's not the case.
I found it's brilliant. I loved meeting Robert Plant. I thought he was such a gent, and we had such a fab time together. Yeah. And the same with Stuart Cable. You know, I met Stuart, we spent a good sort of 6-7 months together doing the book, and him taking me around various important places to him, like Cumamon and like to the first rehearsal studios. One thing I remember being in the Working Man's Club in Cumamon with him having a drink, and I just said to him, a friend of mine who was in Australia, who's a music promoter, she loves drummers and she's married one, her son's becoming a drummer, and she'd said to me, if you ever get a chance, I'd love to have Stuart's autograph, but look, I know it's unprofessional, but if ever the moment's right, you get a chance. So I thought this pub, I said to him, Stuart, you know, I explained to him about her, and I said, if ever you get a chance, you know, one of the Kinford Company flyers we have, your little postcards, would you be able to sign one for her? I'll send it off to her. And he said, I can do better than that. Follow me. And he leapt into his car, and I took my car, and we went to his home just down the road, and he said, wait there. He dashed upstairs, and he brought down 2 drum skins, 4 massive drumsticks, and signed them all, and said, there, send them to her. Which he didn't need to do. It was incredible, you know. And I said before, I'm about Gareth Edwards, you know, that was one of my big heroes. I grew up watching the 70s rugby team, and I'd done a documentary for BBC Wales on the Blues playing in Toulouse in the Highland Cup, and Gareth had been there, and I chatted to him a bit, and it was Rob Howley, Neil Jenkins, you know, at the time. And a week later, when we got back, I was doing a press conference at Cardiff Rugby Club, and Gareth was in front of me, and he opened the door, and he said, after you, Jeff. And I just remember thinking, Gareth Edwards knew my name. He remembered it. It's funny how little things mean so much. But, you know, they do.
Right, I think, you know, you've mentioned Stuart Cable. So, you know, we've mentioned many, many, you know, world-famous rock stars. This book you did with Stuart Cable, they're still, Stereophon is still massively popular, of course. How do you reflect on that time? I mean, there's no need to relay the history of what happened with Stuart. We all know that. But how do you reflect on that, being so close to the man, you know, for 6 or 7 months, as you say? How did he reflect on what happened to him? But also then, how do you reflect on how that played out ultimately?
Well, we it was all a bit sad. We actually did a chapter. I submitted the book, and then about 2 months later, just before they published it, have I got time to sneak in another chapter? Because they met at a friend's wedding, and it was the first time they'd spoken in 2 years, and they all got on really well, and kind of almost made up, which they'd left on a bad note. And it was just one of those unfortunate things when people grow apart, because they grew up together, and the band was supposed to be a rock band. They grew up, you know, listening to AC/DC and Rush. That was Kelly and Stuart's favourite bands. And as I say, Kelly Jones wanted to call the band after Stuart's mum, Mabel Cable. He thought that was a great name. He said, let's call ourselves Mabel Cable. Yeah. And Stuart's like, no, we're not having that. And his dad had a big stereo system. Do you remember when, you know, the stereo players used to be like a cabinet, didn't they? And he would open it up.
Yeah.
And he had one of these big stereo cabinets. It was called a Falcon Stereophonic. And that word always stuck with Stuart, so that's where they got the Stereophonics from. But they just grew up, and they wrote the first 2 albums together, and they were very close, and they rehearsed in a tiny room in Cumamon. But then suddenly, for the 3rd album, Kelly just produced a CD, so I've written the 3rd album, there it is. And there was this poppier album. And I think that was the moment Stuart realised that they were just drifting apart. Kelly was getting more into the London scene and living in London, and Stuart wanted to stay in Wales, and it was just that they drifted apart. But but sometimes when you drift apart, you do it amicably, and sometimes you don't. And Stuart always said that at the end of that third tour, where the album was a bit more poppy, he said, I'm going to walk, I'm leaving the band. As it turned out, they decided to fire him, which was good for him because it meant he got a big payoff.
Yeah.
If he'd left, he'd got nothing, so he got a massive payoff. And he was, whilst he was sad to leave the band, he knew he couldn't have stayed with them, because what he wanted, and it was what Killing for Company turned into, a slightly heavier version of the Stereophonics with big, catchy, anthemic choruses.
Yeah.
And if you listen to their first album, which is kind of still out there, it didn't get a proper release, but it was released online. They're a superb band, and all the songs are amazing, and they were what he thought the Stereophonics should progress into, whereas Kelly was going in another direction.
Although
I think recently Kelly's gone back a bit more rockier, actually. He's gone away from pop direction. But I don't think Stuart... Yes, he was bitter that it ended, and that course, the three of them were taken together, didn't find the course he hoped it would. But he kind of realised that they couldn't have stayed together. If they stayed together for another album, they'd have been trading blows, and it would have just totally degenerated. Though having said that, it still played on his mind. Like, again, like I said, the release of the Killing for Company album didn't go as planned. There were certain obstacles and barriers that stopped it coming out on time, and Stuart was a bit dismayed by that. And then the Stereophonics came to town to play the Cardiff City Stadium. They were about to play a tent in Download to 800 people. Stereophonics were in town playing 34,000 at Cardiff City Stadium. And on the weekend, Stuart drank himself to death. I think he was a bit down and a bit depressed about that, the fact that things hadn't worked out at that time for Killing for Company. I think they would have given him another 2 or 3 years. So he was just a bit low. And then that led, sadly, to what happened.
Yeah.
Because I was just shocked, because Stuart, yes, he was a drinker, but you know that 48-hour drinking binge, and I think, you know, and he was just left alone, and it just ended badly, obviously. And I just think he was a bit. It's just those times in life where, you know, when you're a bit low and a bit down, you need people around you, and maybe people weren't around him at that particular time. Maybe the next weekend they would have been.
Yeah.
To say to him, look, we need to call it a day now, let's take you home, let's look after you. And that just didn't happen, because that wasn't really like Stuart. He was a very buoyant, very bubbly chap. He didn't normally get down. And his dad had died when he was 10, and when he died, his son was 10. And so he's left his son, so that was quite sad. But I think Stuart could have achieved so much more. And as I say, normally he was such a bubbly chap, and even so much so, he had a girlfriend at the time he'd only just been seeing, and she tried to, after his death, tried to promote a thing about, you know, we need to put labels on alcohol bottles, warning that they can kill, you know, it's dangerous, don't drink too much. And I think Stuart's mum, who, you know, obviously very sad, she was quite elderly and had outlived him, which was a terrible thing. But even she got involved and said, look, she got in touch with us and said, you've got to stop this. You know, you're actually just taking advantage of my son's name. He wouldn't have wanted this. He knows alcohol kills. Everyone knows alcohol kills. We don't need you to do this. So even, you know, even his mum was aware. You know, Stuart was aware of what was going on and the dangers of drinking like that. But I guess, you know, some people... He was a very... emotional man, so I guess to have a bit of a 48-hour drinking bender is something people do when they get a bit down. But usually, you know, he was a bit more upbeat. So I think just a weak moment caught him.
Multitude of factors.
Yeah,
I mean, these are sadly a staple of sort of rock and roll, aren't they?
And of course, we've seen recently, you know, how depression has hit a few lead singers from various bands who've taken their lives recently. Which is another extreme step, but yeah, it was just a terribly tragic event. And I know, and of course, Stuart touched so many lives. People I know who worked on, when I was on Nation Radio, it had been XFM radio before that, and Stuart had done a show on it, so they all knew him and they were very upset. And I remember getting a phone call at 5 a.m. from Steve Balsamo from The Stories. That was when I first heard it. I think, Jeff, have you heard about Stuart? And then Mike Peters from The Alarm, you know, getting in touch, and just all these lives Stuart had touched. And a very sad death, very needless death, and as I say, I think he could have gone on to achieve so much more, but, you know.
Yeah, well, it goes without saying what an absolutely tragic story that was. But we need to finish on a bit of an upbeat thing. Music's obviously a huge... What would be your all-time, let's go a bit Desert Island Discs, what would be the track or a couple of tracks you wouldn't be able to live without.
God, it's a tricky one. I think there are three bands that have really defined my growing up, my life for the last 40-odd years. I've always been a big ELO fan.
Right.
Ever since my dad brought home Face the Music in 1975 when I was like nine, and he was playing it, and then, you know, New World Record and Out of the Blue, and I just thought ELO were an incredible rock band. And I think Jeff Lynne has the most underrated voice. Whenever you hear people talk about, you know, good singers, this, you know, Rob Plant has a fantastic voice, or Paul Rodgers has a great voice, or someone else, or Adele, you know, people always talk about voices. You never hear anyone mention Jeff Lynne. But if you listen to Telephone Line or Mr. Blue Sky, his voice is incredible. I don't know why he doesn't get more credit for being a singer. Again, Led Zeppelin were such a huge band growing up. And again, I was so glad, thanks to interviewing Robert Plant, I got to go to the reunion gig at the O2. Yeah. Which was
got a complimentary for
yeah,
that.
Which was amazing. We got to go to that. We had a backstage pass. I got to the security was so tired I couldn't interview Zeppelin. And I tried to interview some of the other back support bands, like the members of Yes, Nemestek and Palmer. There, got to do Paul Rodgers, and that was very surreal. Yeah. We interviewed him about his career with Free and Bad Company, and then as we come to the end of the interview, Foreigner, who were also on Zeppelin's label and also on that part of that bill. They were rehearsing "I Want to Know What Love Is" with a choir, and it was drifting across. As I'm doing the interview, you can hear, you know, "I want to know what love is." That was quite surreal. But Zeppelin was such an immense band. Yeah. And again, every album is so good. When you try and name what's your favourite Zeppelin album, it changes every month, you know. And then the number one band for me, and again, I've been very lucky. I've interviewed most of the band down the years. I've become quite friendly with the keyboard player Jeff Downes, who was also in the band Asia, who were the biggest selling band in 82 when the album was there for 9 weeks. Yeah, yeah. And he was part of the Buggles and wrote Video Killed the Brave Star. Yeah. I remember him telling me a great story. They were saying they didn't really tour as the Buggles, and they supported Tina Charles on a few gigs, you know, I Love to Love. And then their first gig was in a stadium with tens of thousands of people with Yes. It was a terrifying experience. But Yes, for me, were a huge band. I used to love John Anderson's voice. And of course, you know, he worked with Vangelis. He was the John in John of Vangelis. Beautiful, sweet, high-pitched voice. And yeah, Yes were one of those bands that just every album they did was just perfect. The musicianship, I think they're the best example. The musicianship is perfect. And you listen to that and you think, how on earth do they play guitar like that, or play keyboards like that, or drum like that? You know, with the likes of Rick Wakeman and Steve Howe. Just incredible musician. And I've seen them live so many times. And when you see them live, they are note for note perfect. And it's staggering to see. And again, they're the one band, when I listen to any of their albums, you know, the hairs just stand up on the back of my neck. And you just think, this sounds... Well, for example, their most popular song, I mean, Owner of a Lonely Heart. And I mentioned Asia just now. But if you listen to Asia's song, Heat of the Moment, which is a big worldwide number one everywhere, but it's kind of got a very dense production, and it does sound very 80s. Even though it's still a great song, a very catchy song, you can tell it's from the 80s, and it's got that production. You play Owner of a Lonely Heart... and Trevor Horn's production, all those little percussive sound effects and keyboard sound effects, it sounds like it was made yesterday. It's still, the production, the space, the clarity, it's crystal clear, and nothing sounds dated about it. And it was made in 83, you know, so it's 35. It's incredible that it could easily be made yesterday. I think that's one of the key things, is their stuff still sounds so fresh. So yeah, for me, I would say, ELO, Led Zeppelin, Yes, anything by them.
That's
make
the Desert
me a happy
Island,
man.
That's got a good mix. I know.
That's the Desert Island jukebox.
Yeah.
Huge thanks to Jeff Collins there. Had a great hour with Jeff. He's got so many stories. We barely scratched the surface, to be honest, so I must get him on again. And I really appreciate his patience, because Jeff was one of the people I managed to delete so heroically a couple of months ago. So he showed great patience doing the interview twice for me. So that was marvellous, and we'll definitely hear again from Jeff in the future, I'm sure. But that's it for this week for the Cardiff Podcast. Thanks very much for listening, and see you again soon. Thank you.